The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the ninth episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. The interview that you're going to hear a little bit later on is with Daryl Booker. And Daryl Booker, if you don't know, is the general manager of Mission Hill Winery. He used to be the winemaker, and he just moved over and is now the general manager overseeing all aspects of the winemaking culture there in Mission Hill. We don't know, Mission Hill, Okanagan, a brilliant winery, really good stuff. I think some people can be a little bit cynical because they look at Mission Hill and they see the amount of wine that's made. And if you go and visit their winery, it is a wonderland. It is gorgeous. It's right by the water. There's concerts that go on. And I think sometimes when a winery feels really touristy, we can forget that they actually make great wine. We love the idea that the winery just being a little farming operation, a little mom and pop, and you know they don't have time for capitalism. They're too busy making sure all the tenants are in shape and all that kind of stuff. And in reality, you can be both. You can be a P.T. Barnum-esque wine tourism mecca and still make great wine, and Mission Hill does. And Daryl started in Australia, worked in Niagara, and then BC. So he's seen a lot of different terroir, a lot of different temperatures, soils, all sorts of things. So a really great interview. It's about 20, 25 minutes long. It was a little bit shorter because we were getting set to do an event for the National Club here in Toronto, just around King and Bay Street. He was serving the wine, so I didn't want to take up too much of his time. So what I want to talk about, I want to review a wine, and I also want to give some tips, and this is especially for more the wine enthusiast. If you're the hardcore wine person, I'll be preaching to the choir. I'm not going to lie. But what I want to do is give some recommendations for alternates from the normal wine you drink. I find over the holidays, you usually drink more, except for a lot of us where the holidays is just another day. But I was at a Christmas party last night, and the one thing I always notice is, you know, people are being handed glasses of red and white, and they don't always acknowledge what it is, or they don't even know what it is. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes you're not supposed to, every glass of wine isn't just there to brood over with a candle as you're trying to figure out exactly, was there any Malo in this Chardonnay, and what sort of barrique was used for the Cabernet. I'm not talking that, but I don't know. Any time I get, you know, pass the glass of wine, even if it's late in the evening, I'll still just take a sip and consider for a second, okay, what am I drinking? And the more I've drank, quite often I will have no idea. But it just got me realizing I could never do that. I could never just blindly drink every glass. And I think part of it is that a lot of wine starts to become bland. And often we just buy the same things. And if you're always drinking the same thing, then on one level, it's great. You want it's like your comfort food. We all have those. I have the wines that I drink more than any others. But at the same point, every now and then, you want to sort of just get out of your comfort zone for a little bit. I think I over-explained this, but I'll get into it a bit. I got some thoughts on just some different wines to buy, to try over the holiday season. The wine that I am going to be reviewing, it's rare when you get to have a lot of New World aged Riesling. One of the most famous Rieslings in the New World is called Grosset Wines, based in Australia in an area called Clare Valley. And for a lot of people, you think Australia, you think hot temperature, and that's true. But Clare Valley actually makes some of the best Riesling in Australia. I'd say the best Riesling in Australia, pound for pound, and some of the best New World Riesling out there. And the reason is Clare Valley is at a higher altitude, which means temperatures will swing, especially at night. You'll get low nighttime temperatures. The slopes, it's a west-facing slope, so it can help protect from the sun, afternoon breezes. There's a lot of different things that go into it. But Clare Valley has the coolness to make good acidic Riesling. And the one I have is the Grosset wine from a single vineyard called Polish Hill. and it's 2006. And the Polish Hill, organic vineyard, all hand-picked. This is some really dynamite stuff. And what I like on the nose, it's had time. You know, this wine has seen 12 years. So the fruits are a little bit more ripe, like ripe pear. You also get some honey. And honey often, if you smell honey, that can often be an indicator for white wine that it's seen some age. You get lemon, and of course, you get the kerosene, which is the, you know, you always hear about that descriptor with Riesling. That might sound weird, but it's true. Kerosene. And it's really well balanced. Like, it's just the fruit and the kerosene and some tertiary, and it's got some age and some spice, and like just on the nose. This is a wine where I guarantee if you were knee deep in a Christmas party and, you know, you're sitting there having whatever cheese and crackers or sliders, whatever you're eating, and you're having whatever conversation, someone throws a glass of this in your hand and you will take notice. You will recognize, damn, what am I drinking? You just right away, you're like, this is something different. There is something really good going on. And on the palate, just when you hear the term grippy minerality, that is this throughout. This is a dry wine. There's a nice long winding road of acidity that keeps this whole wine together. And same on the palate, ripe pear, lemon, some honey. I get spicy green apple, some more floral notes. It's almost a little bit smoky. Yeah, this is a wine immediately you're going to recognize this is something a little different if you just haven't drunk a lot of Riesling from the New World. And also that this, the age, it just adds a lot of complexity. So I want to talk about and I'll keep it quick because I feel like I'm rambling. I'm staring out at the Christmas market here in the distillery district in Toronto. And then my mind just goes on 400 topics. Like, why is everyone waiting in line? And by the way, try the mulled wine. You know, it's fun. Try the mulled wine. I wouldn't recommend, you know, drinking on a regular basis, but give it a try. It's fun. So you often drink sparkling over the holidays. You know, you're in a celebratory mood. Get away from Prosecco or Cava and try Cremant. I think I've talked about Cremant in a past podcast. Basically, it's sparkling wine made the exact same way as champagne, but because it's not made in Champagne in that expensive area, I mean, if you want to buy vineyard land there, it's some of the most expensive on planet Earth. So it's much cheaper. It's usually around $19 or $22. Now, it doesn't have all the same complexity or depth as champagne. Nothing does. But it has more than most of the Prosecco or Cava that you get, certainly here in Southern Ontario. I can't speak to other countries just in terms of the sourcing and the quality Prosecco you get. But here, the stuff you get is fine. It's pleasant. It's a little bit sweet. It's got a lot of fruit, and it's good. But Cremant adds more depth, and for about $4 or $5 more, it's a great value. Instead of Chardonnay, and by the way, I just don't have time for the, ugh, I hate Chardonnay. To me, that's ridiculous. A, where does champagne come from? So much of it comes from Chardonnay. And you've got the dry, the New World dry stuff. You've got, you know, Chablis. You've got all of Burgundy. You've got the beautiful, well-oaked stuff in Sonoma, Napa. And by the way, Santa Barbara as well. But I want to recommend Chenin Blanc. For people who haven't had it, it's very popular there's two places where you find it the most, in the Loire region in France and in South Africa, where about 20% of all vineyard space is Chenin Blanc. And what I love about this wine is there is so much range. You can get some stuff that's semi-dry, that's a little bit of sweetness from Loire, where you get more, you know, pear and peach, to the really, really dry stuff from a little area called Sauvignère. In South Africa, little bit more tropical notes, not as much acid as what you're going to find in Loire, but still a lot of acid. And what I like about Chenin Blanc is it can be fairly well-rounded, and there's a lot of depth and there's a lot of flavor. So it's a good alternative from Chardonnay. If you still want something that is fairly big, and you can find plenty of Chenin Blanc that's like it, but you just want to try something different. And by the way, if you still want to do Chardonnay, great, knock yourself out. May I recommend Hawke's Bay in New Zealand? It's a very famous wine-growing region at the southern part of the North Island in New Zealand, and it's famous for Syrah. I was there a couple of years ago, and the Chardonnay that we was consistently fantastic throughout. So if you find, if you're at your liquor store and you go to the New Zealand section and it says Chardonnay from Hawke's Bay, grab a bottle. Same way, try some Chenin Blanc from South Africa, and in Loire, you're gonna have to ask, because again, like Vouvray or Savinière, it's France. They don't put the name of the grape on the bottle because they like to confuse you. But if you can seek it out, try to find some Chenin Blanc. Syrah. I mentioned Syrah with Hawke's Bay. Syrah in Northern Rhone is the most famous place for it. But let me recommend a different area for Syrah. I'm talking about Washington State. And specifically, I mean, try Washington State Syrah. It's growing and growing in popularity. It's just, it really works well in that state. And the one region I recommend, if you can find it, Walla Walla. I mean, yes, it sounds like something Bugs Bunny would say he's coming from as he's going off to Albuquerque. But if you can find, which is like a smaller appellation, smaller region within Washington State, Walla Walla, the Syrahs there are fantastic. One that comes to mind, the Cayuse, C-A-Y-U-S-E, Kalu Vineyard, makes some of the best Syrahs I've ever had. I put it up against tons of Cote Rôti. And this is an area that went from 450 acres to now there's over 3,000 acres of Syrah in the Walla Walla region. I mean, heck, there's been some that are now, a couple of years ago, the winery, and it's just called K, the capital K, the K Syrah Walla Walla Valley Powerline Estate. Their 2014, I think, was number two on Wine Spectator of the top 100 list. And I know that list can be fraught and there's issues with it, but at the same point, it's number two. So damn good. Two other ones, quick recommendations. If you want something big and powerful, but you just want something different than, say, Cabernet or Merlot, try Mourvèdre from France, and specifically from a region called Bandol. Again, a smaller region within Provence. This is big, meaty, powerful, good tannins. I mean, still balanced, a lot of dark fruit on it, but this is a smoky, meaty, delicious red wine. And finally, everyone drinks a lot of Sauvignon Blanc, and sometimes you get tired of the New Zealand stuff because you feel it's a little just too powerful, and maybe you're not into Sancerre or other parts of Loire. The one area that people don't really drink as much, at least I haven't seen, and I know it's, I got to drink more of it, is in Bordeaux. White Bordeaux, which is, of course, it's Bordeaux, it's a blend. So it's going to be Sauvignon Blanc with some Semillon. That's like the classic, and there'll be other blends here and there. But that's usually the main one. I don't want to go down too much of a lesson on White Bordeaux. But if you're in Ontario, and I imagine because I can find it all over Ontario, that it's in other wine or other wine stores throughout Canada or the United States. Le G, just it's a capital G on it. Le G de Chateau Gironde. Fantastic. Now they, and I've mispronounced it, G-U-I-R-A-U-D. And in fact, I tasted this wine, if you remember back to the second podcast with Bruce Wallner, the Master Somm. And I wanted to throw it out there again because I just bought a couple more bottles. And it is a great Sauvignon Blanc. It is really good, really original, really fun. Go back, listen to the second podcast for the proper pronunciation. Bruce will give that to you. I do not. I apologize. And his tasting notes, which went about 7 minutes, but I thought it was really fascinating. So there's just a couple ideas. Cremant over Prosecco, Chenin Blanc over Chardonnay. If you're going to drink Chardonnay, try from Hawke's Bay in New Zealand. Instead of Northern Rhone Syrah, which is damn expensive, try, and this though not cheap, Walla Walla Valley in Washington State for your Syrah. And again, Mourvèdre from Bandol in Provence from France instead of Cabernet Sauvignon. So that is it for me. Rambling as always. I really appreciate everyone listening to the podcast. You can find, I was going to say us, but it's me, on iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom. I'll see about finding other avenues to get it on, but I'm just not that smart when it comes to technology. I'm amazed I got it on all three of those. Tell your friends. And again, the key for this podcast is want to make it fun. Some education as well. You're going to get a lot in a second with Daryl Booker. And just trying to find that right line, because wine is not supposed, I say it every time, wine is not supposed to be intimidating. It's supposed to be fun. You know, just like at the Christmas party, you can have it both ways. You can just have the glass because, you know, you like wine and you don't want to think about it. But at the same point in the evening, isn't it nice then to have another glass where in the middle of your conversation, you stop, you take notice, and you're like, damn, this smells good. This tastes good. What the bleep am I drinking? And just enjoy that moment and then go back to the conversations and everything else. So without further ado, the general manager of Mission Hill, Daryl Booker. Daryl, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Thanks, Matt. I'm happy to be here.
So for people who don't know, you were, and I'd love to do a little bit of your bio. You used to work in Niagara with Flat Rock Cellars and did work with Trius, Cedar Creek. And then you moved over. You were the winemaker for Mission Hill, and now you're the general manager. And I love reading your role. You're responsible for all aspects of everything. But before we get to that, I just wanted to just talk a little bit about your time in Australia, and just how did you get into wine?
Yeah, great question. It all started out, I didn't come from a wine family, so it was really, I guess, just drinking wine. My wife comes from the Hunter Valley, so when we go to visit her family, it's either do I go and tour wineries or hang out with in-laws? So, you know, the wineries won over. And it really started from a passion for wine, and then I started reading more and more, and I thought, wow, you can do this for a career. So I enrolled in university to study winemaking, and away it went. But I'd been in the Navy for about 4 years in the Australian Navy, and traveled around and just loved wine. So decided that was my future.
So that's different than a lot of people where they, like when I interviewed Tom Eddy, he knew from like the age of 17 that he was going to be into it. Corsini, his family owned vineyards. For you, I'm going to say self-made man, but it's not like the others are. You got to work your ass off to get to where they are. But you have a bit of a different path, I imagine, than a lot of the other winemakers that you probably spend time with.
Yeah, definitely. And I noticed that at university. So many people there had come from wine families, and they knew that's what they were going to do, to take over their family winery. So I think it gave me an advantage, and I felt really hungry. It's like, okay, I'm going to prove that I belong in this industry. So It was a lot of fun, and steep learning curve when you don't come from a wine family. But When you love what you're doing, it's not too hard.
What I always find interesting about Australian winemaking is just how much more reliant, how much more self-sufficient you have to be. You're just in the corner of the world. Same thing with New Zealand. And how much more, you know, dry farming and science and, you know, just because of issues with water. What are some of the hardest issues that winemakers in Australia have to deal with that Italy, North America, Canada, France don't have?
Yeah, I think extreme conditions is one thing for sure. You know, the summers are so hot. I remember my first year in the Barossa Valley, and I was painting the picking bins with a paint as we did every year. And it was so warm, I had to start at around 1 a.m. because I was spraying the picking bins with paint to get them ready for the season.
Yeah.
And the paint was drying before I could even hit the bins if I was starting later than 1 a.m. because it was...
What?
Yeah. We were 45 degrees during the day, and we never dropped below 30 degrees at night for about 2 weeks. So extreme conditions is definitely one of them, but also being on your own, it's easy to become insular. So you have to work really hard to try wine from around the world. And,
right.
And, you know, I'm talking 20 plus years ago now, and it was tough to get great wines in Australia 20 years ago.
I mean, it'd be so much more difficult just because the infrastructure of importing and exporting. I mean, it always amazes me. I think New Zealand is always a success story. It's the tiniest little country, and yet their wine is everywhere. And is it difficult in Australia back then for just being very monolithic in the wine you're making because you don't have as many other examples around you?
Absolutely. And you mentioned New Zealand. The winemaker I worked for was actually a Kiwi. Mm-hmm. And so we were trying old New Zealand wines. And after a few years in the Barossa, I was like, that's it. I want to move to New Zealand. I saw what there was in cool climate wines and the acidity and the freshness. But not many people in Australia were exposed to that at the time. So for me, it was, okay, that's it. I'm jumping across to New Zealand.
We will get to Mission Hill, because I want to talk about Compendium, Perpetua, like Oculus, all these wines. And we're here tonight at the National Club because you're doing an event for the National Club, displaying a lot of your fantastic wines. But just one last question about Australia. Where are they now? Because it seems the pendulum swings with them. It's, you know, no one knows a lot. Then successive Yellowtail and big, bold wines, which New World palates love. And then, of course, there's a backlash against it. And the pendulum always swings back and forth. I'm wondering what is the state? And it's a general question, but even just a couple impressions, the state of Australia with the wine.
Yeah, I think it's swinging back up again because it did take a big swing back. But Australia's had about five boom and bust cycles, and they're certainly coming back into boom. And what they've done, Australia's very resilient, and so they're recreating brand Australia from a wine point of view, and they're regionalising it. It used to be all Australian wine was known as one country, and that was it. And
yeah.
Whereas now they're really focusing on the microclimates and the cool climates down in Tasmania, and they're really talking about the differences in Australia, just like you would in France or Italy. So I think it's a smart move, and it's definitely swinging back.
You know what, then? We're going to jump ahead. I had some other personal questions about you, but we'll just bounce around the interview because what you said there. One of the toughest things, I think, for both Ontario and I imagine for BC is to get the true legitimacy of the great wines that are available. It is about just drilling down on the microclimates, and that it's not just one giant appellation. Niagara is not Niagara. There's, you know, there's Hidden Bench, there's 20 Benches, there's all these different areas. I imagine that's one of the big hurdles that needs to happen to allow for Canadian wine to be sort of judged on a higher level when you realize, Osoyoos, okay, well, that's going to be a lot harder than closer to the Okanagan area.
Yeah, definitely. And it is, because people just think regions often when they think Canada now. And so it's about producing wines that get people's attention. And there's no time to say, well, this is good for a Canadian wine. You need to be good on the world stage.
Yeah.
And that's the most important part. And drilling into the microclimates, both Niagara and Okanagan just have some amazing microclimates that you can really tell a story through. So it's one of the most exciting parts.
What did you know about Mission Hill before you joined them?
I knew a little bit, not a lot though, to be honest. It was, you know, I knew them as a winery that was focused on vineyards, but and very premium production. There was a vision, but I didn't know as much as I should have known, to be honest. I respected what they did, but it was one of the few wineries that I hadn't spent a lot of time at in the Okanagan. So it was a nice surprise. Yeah.
What are some, for people that are just getting into wine, what would you say are the biggest differences between Ontario and, I'll be specific, Niagara region, Prince Edward County? Those are two of the bigger ones. And apologies to North Shore and Erie and some places like that. But between, like, say, Niagara, Prince Edward, and where you work, and just the vineyards from up in Okanagan all the way down south near the border to the desert-like Osoyoos area.
Yeah, definitely. So if you look at even Prince Edward County to Niagara, they're very different regions and very different expressions. And we see that in the Okanagan Valley. It's 200 kilometers long, but it's only a few kilometers wide, even as at its widest point. It's about 4 kilometers wide. And just diversity. You know, it was formed, it's glacially formed about 12,000 years ago. And it also has volcanic rock. You just have incredible diversity. We have 36 different vineyard sites from north to south, and all of them have different soil, different elevation, different aspects. So I think that's really, and you touched on it, it's really the diversity that we see. And that's, Niagara was very diverse, but I've never seen in any wine region of the world as much diversity as I see in the Okanagan, from clay soils to sandy soils to rocky vineyards, and it's absolutely incredible.
I don't think what a lot of people realize, and I've said the word Osoyoos a couple times, and for people who don't know, it's a wine-growing appellation, wine-growing area near, right at the bottom of British Columbia, near the border to the United States. I had no idea until I started learning about it that it's a desert. We don't think of Canada, we don't think of desert, but you're growing grapes from desert.
Yeah, definitely in the southern half of the Okanagan. It starts in Mexico. It's a Sonoran desert, comes all the way up through the U.S. and the tip of it finishes there, and it truly is a desert. And yeah, the other thing people don't realize when you look at the Okanagan Valley, we're between the 49th and 50th parallel, which is much further north than Niagara, as an example. And so even though it's really warm, we also get incredibly long days. And so that's a big part. And that was my first shock. I remember I moved out in May from Niagara out to the Okanagan in 2010. And the sun's up at like 4:15 in the morning and it sets about 10:30 at night. So really, really long, intense days. So I consider ourselves cool climate for 9 months of the year. But for 3 months of the year, we're actually a warm climate.
So what is your role with Mission Hill? What's the biggest difference? Obviously, because I read on the bio, responsible for all aspects of winemaking, viticulture, guest experience at Mission Hill Family Estate. He also oversees the Sebastian Farms and the Von Mandel Family Collection. It goes on and on. And by the way, let me say, I've never had a guest experience as good as I did when I went to Mission Hill 2 years ago. It was ridiculous. I won't go into the whole story, but I'll say this. Our tour started about 2:30. I went to bed about 8 p.m.
Oh, nice.
It was a full debaucherous sort of day. But what are your roles as general manager for Mission Hill?
Yeah, it's really, you know, my history and my passion is winemaking and viticulture. So that's first and foremost is, I guess, keeping an eye on that. But we've just hired a new winemaker to look after day-to-day winemaking. So that's worked out really well. Spend a lot of time in the vineyards. You know, we have a lot of acres from north to south. And so that's a big part of my role. But it's also the guest experience, as you say. It's having an emotional connection with our guests, making sure they're all getting what they want to get and discovering something new, whether it's their first time visiting or their 10th time visiting.
What would you say is the difference in the impression that the rest of the world has on BC wine from, say, the early 2000s to now? And you guys have had success winning multiple awards at the Decanter Wine Awards, which is a pretty major one because what Wine Spectator is to North America, Decanter is to the world. So just, I was wondering if you can tell some of the differences between 10, 15 years and today.
Oh, definitely. And it's funny you say Wine Spectator. So just as an example, Decanter is, I've been to the UK a few times as we're setting up distribution and selling some wine there. But I was in New York about a month ago at the New York Wine Experience.
Yep.
And yeah, so Oculus was invited to pour. This is our fifth year in a row. The only Canadian wine ever invited. But now, you know, pouring there in the right in Times Square in New York, and the amount of people that are coming up and they know Canadian wine now and they're excited to try Canadian wine, and you know it scored really well with Wine Spectator. It's playing amongst the well-known wines from around the world, so that's exciting. And having all these passionate wine lovers, and a lot from Toronto actually coming down, and there would have been 60-70 people came to the table from Toronto, and they're just all excited to try Canadian wine. So that's a big change, but it was a novelty 15 years ago, and now people are realizing that it belongs on the world stage.
Yeah, I think novelty is the right way, and novelty is just, what a wild insult to the winemakers and everyone involved at the winery, from the people who clean stainless steel tanks to the people picking grapes to everyone above. Like, we're going to try a little bit of your Oculus, and there is nothing novelty about this wine. And when I'm going to be saying a couple words for the event tonight, and the one word the one sort of expression I was thinking of is this wine and a lot of your other wines, they're almost a Trojan horse to the rest of the wine world, where you push this one in, and this is the one that gets sort of like, then there are a bunch, but this is one that can sort of break out globally, where people realize it's not novelty. This is powerful, age-worthy, delicate wine. And I think Mission Hill is going to be one of the tip of the spears for that.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's about consistency. Anyone can, well, not anybody, but you can make a good wine 1 year if everything lines up. Mm-hmm. You've got to do it year over year over year. And when it comes to Oculus, trialed it in 97. Mission Hill's been making Oculus since 1998. So.
And what's the blend for people that just don't know what Oculus
is?
That is your most high, I don't like to use the word high end, but you know, it's certainly at the top of your portfolio of wines.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So Oculus is a blend using the classic Bordeaux varietals, but I don't even really like to say that term because it's distinctly Canadian. So it's a blend of Merlot and then generally followed with Cabernet Franc and or Cabernet Sauvignon. It always has two, but that order might change, and then Petit Verdot is the fourth variety as well. Yeah.
I was amazed by that the first time when I went there, just the quality of the Syrah and the quality of the Merlot. Were two of the ones that really sort of opened my eyes to what Okanagan can do.
Oh, definitely, and that's the exciting part. You know, when I first moved to Canada, and it was Niagara to start with, my wife and I were in New Zealand at the time. We thought, oh, a year or two in Canada, then we'll go back to Australia. And after a couple of years here, it's so exciting to be in a country on both sides of the country where it's just being elevated year over year over year, and we're making great wines already. But you know that we can just get better, and I love just seeing Canadians turning to Canadian wine and saying, and understanding Canadian wine is great. It's really exciting.
Well, I remember being at an event with Checkmate Winery, and it was an event here, and they were doing pouring all their different Chardonnays. And in the middle of them, they put in some Meursault, and they put in some high-end Sonoma. And, you know, the Checkmate, you know, was able to compete. At the very least, it was on equal planes. And I come from the world of sports. Mm. And, you know, it's like you can always tell the great athlete when not only do they belong, you know, but they can dominate. And it was the same thing here. It's like these wines belong with your traditional, you know, high-end wines from France. And that was another one that sort of opened my eyes. Is there vindication? Do you feel any sort of vindication? Because I imagine there's a lot of people that look down on, still do, look down on Ontario wine as novelty.
Oh, definitely. And we, you know, it's going to go for many more years, changing people's mind. But
yeah,
you just do that one person at a time. You get a glass in their hand and you surprise them. And once you've got them for life. And, you know, because they can see and understand the quality. But there's definitely, you have to change people's mindset. And you can only do that by proving that you can make great wine.
When you're a winemaker, either... Well, let's go through all three of them. First, in Australia, what would be an example of a tough day for you?
Yeah, a tough day. A tough day in Australia is actually working in the vineyard all day because it's so hot. And
how much suntan lotion did you have?
Yeah,
on?
Yeah, a lot, and you wear a lot of hats, and But Australia is a great spot to make wine. You are battling the weather though, and I was back there in May this year. The end of harvest for us in Canada, sometimes it's snowing.
Yeah.
It was. I was in Coonawarra, and it was 34 degrees at the end of harvest.
Oh, my
you know?
God.
And, so, you know, just how warm it can be there is because heat generates alcohol, so you have to be careful to balance the two. And I love Australian wine, but they're feeling global warming. So that's the real challenge is the weather there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, I mean, people in southern England love global warming if you want to make wine,
exactly.
But... Yeah. Germany's going to feel it. And then the hotter climates. How much do you worry about that?
A lot, actually, a lot. You know, it's no one truly benefits. There might be regions that become more viable, but global warming's not good for anybody because it's the ups and downs and the crazy weather systems that you get and the unreliable weather systems that create the real issues.
Yeah. Well, don't tell Trump. He will say that you're doing his fake news. What level of insecurity? I'm always curious about this. Take us, Daryl. To just add Daryl the winemaker, your moments of greatest insecurity in a vintage.
Yeah, I think when you're trying something different or you have a vision for a style, there's always doubt, and everybody will tell you that in most professions. I remember my first year in the Okanagan, I wanted to make a very terroir-driven Chardonnay, and so it was this high-altitude block of Chardonnay right in the north end of the Okanagan, and I decided not to put it through malolactic, which softens the acid.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I'm not going to soften the acid because I really want to show the site and the acid in the site. And I remember trying it, and the owner of the winery, this was Cedar Creek Winery at the time. I didn't show him for about 6 months the wine because I'm thinking he won't understand it. So you have that insecurity.
So you hid it. You hid it from him.
Yeah, yeah. Will this wine be accepted? And, so that's really, I think for me, it's really when you're trying something new, you have confidence in yourself, but there's always self-doubt. And self-doubt's good. Otherwise, you get cocky.
Yeah. So... We are. What do we got here? What do we got in the? What do we have in the glass?
Yeah, this is 2009 Oculus. So I think a fantastic vintage. 2009. It's nearly 10 years old now. Just past 9 years, and it's really for me when Oculus really hits its stride. It is roughly 10 years old. So once again, Merlot dominant blend, but only at about 50%. The rest is Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Petit Verdot.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could, and I've done this with a couple of the other Psalms I've interviewed, if you could sort of smell, taste it, and tell the audience what you get on the nose and on the palate.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for me, the nose, it's still got primary fruit. It's still got that red berry and the plum sort of notes to it. But it's just turning over to what we call secondary characters. So secondary characters are a little bit of cigar box and leather, which doesn't sound that attractive on the radio, but when you're smelling it, it's
could
amazing.
Be worse. Could be cat pee and manure and barnyard.
Exactly. And I love a wine that has some primary fruit and some secondary characters. And that's where this wine sits. It's still slightly more primary fruit, but I love seeing that leather and cigar box, those traditional red characters, and come through. So for the nose, that's really what I like about this. And I'm just going to have a quick taste before.
Yeah,
I
go. Absolutely, this people do it all the time. This podcast, I'm sorry that you can't spit anywhere. You're going to have to suffer through and swallow.
Yeah, I'll survive. so for me, still really bright acid, which I love in this wine. And we don't normally talk about acid in a red wine, but it's important for aging, important for freshness. So for me, there's tannins. The tannins are round. The tannins are softening, but still really, really fresh. This wine at 9 years old, I think, has another 8 to 10 years ahead of it. So it's going to be great to drink tonight with a great meal. But it's, you've still got red berry fruit coming through, round tannins, nice line of acidity and freshness.
Is that one of the, I always imagine that must be one of the most difficult things as a winemaker or just overseeing it all. when you do a Bordeaux blend, when you do something dominant, you know, Cab Franc, Cab Sauv, or Merlot, to have that balance between power and still some delicacy. I always appreciate that about the Tom Eddy wines. And it can be the hard thing. You know, you get Napa Cab or a lot of Australian wines where you're getting hit over the head. You're getting a lot of that power and that fruit, and it's pleasing on one level, but it gets a little overwhelming, and the freshness and the acidity sometimes, especially in hotter climates, can get lost. How difficult is that to just straddle that line?
Yeah, I think it's a learning curve, because most things in winemaking are about making a decision and seeing the results of that decision, and sometimes it's 5 and 10 years later. And so I used to think that to make a wine that would age and to make a red wine, it had to be over-extracted and really big tannin. And then after a while, you realize you can have power and elegance in the same wine. And so for me, it's about getting ripe tannins. It all comes back to the vineyard. When I first started in winemaking, it was like, okay, I can do everything in the winery. But you realize very quickly, just like a chef, if you don't have great produce, then you can't make a great meal. And it's the same in winemaking. So it's getting it right in the vineyard, making sure your cropping levels are right, and making sure you're picking at the right time, that you've got beautiful ripe tannins. And then you can have power and elegance all in the same glass, and you don't need big hit you over the head tannins.
Do a lot of winemakers and you don't have to name names, if you want to, even better. Is there pressure on some wineries to pick a little bit later, let the grapes get a little more plump, so it gets a little more fat, a little more fruit, a little more alcohol, to try to satiate often people's taste for just big?
Definitely. And they used to be the wines that would show up in wine shows. You know, when you're going through and you're trying 100 red wines, the big over-the-top wines that may not be great to drink a whole bottle, but when you first smell them and taste them. But there's a big shift now. People aren't looking for 16% alcohol wines. They're looking for wines with elegance and still power, but elegance at the same time. And I think that's where Canada, both sides of the country, is positioned well, because we have wines with elegance, and we can't make the big jammy shriveled wines, and we don't want to. And like everything in the wine world, I think it's shifting in our favor and our style of wine.
Where would you like to see Mission Hill and BC wines in general over the next 20 years? What do you see out of it?
Yeah, I really want to see us in the great restaurants and the great cities around the world. And that's not about an ego. It's about putting ourselves on a level playing field. And I want to see us in the great.
By the way, sorry to interrupt. Nothing wrong with ego.
Yeah.
There is a difference between strong ego and large ego.
Yeah.
Large ego is we're going to be better than Latour and DRC and but strong ego is you want to be at the number one places.
Exactly. Yeah. And for me, I want to be, when I think of Australia, I think of a few wines like, let's say, Grange from Penfolds. And I want to be known as the Canadian wine around the world. When people think, what's a great wine from Canada? Oh, Oculus is an amazing wine from Canada. I want to be at the table.
Yeah. That's perfect answer. So I'll leave you with this question, and we can finish off a little bit of the little slice left of the 09 Oculus. The one that I don't even know. Were you there at the time? This could be a horrible question to end with, because maybe you weren't there. What were Prince William and Kate Middleton like?
I was there, actually. They were great. So the interesting part was that they had a great day set up and lots of restaurants. It was very communal, and a great kids section where the kids were doing cooking and all that sort of stuff. It was great. And then we got them down into the cellar, and there were no cameras down in the cellar because they can't be filmed drinking alcohol. But of course, but they wanted to drink alcohol.
Hold on, couldn't be on film. Is this like part of the protocol?
Yes.
Okay, so royalty, and they were there. I should have done the introduction better. What were they doing visiting with you guys at Mission Hill?
Yeah, so they were visiting Canada. It was on their royal tour, and they decided to come to the Okanagan Valley for a day. So, with their limited schedule, they came to Mission Hill, and we invited great restaurants, farmers.
Hell of a coup by you guys, by
the way. We were lucky. It was good. They came down into our underground barrel cellar, and we asked them if they'd like to thief some wine, and what that means is sticking the glass thief into the barrel and drawing wine out of the barrel. So they were really excited, really inquisitive, and incredibly nice. They both drank the wine. They commented on the wine. We're trying a Cabernet Franc out of barrel, actually, and they loved it. So, I was really impressed with how down to earth they were.
What's security like?
Security was intense. It was very intense, but in the background, they certainly weren't in the way. Yeah.
Prince William, did he give some tasting notes? Did he, was he swirling? Did anyone spit? I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, he gave me some tips, told me, I should have picked a little bit later. And the
he did
weren't
not.
Quite, no, he didn't really.
That'd be hilarious.
No, they were just asked a few questions about the variety and what makes Okanagan wine unique, et cetera. So it was a quick, they were only down there for about 5 minutes, but a good chat on the wines and really interested and, you know, it felt like we really had their attention. So it was quite special.
Well, certainly because of that, because of winning awards and just the consistent production and the consistent quality, speaking of the word attention, I think Mission Hill, there's a bunch of wineries that are starting to gain global attention, and it's so important. And all right, go off another tangent, then we'll go because I know the event's coming up. But how is the community in Okanagan? Because you go to some parts of France and in Italy, and it can be a little bit more, we're not sharing our secrets. Is it more communal because you're all sort of working together for the same goal?
Absolutely. Whether it's Okanagan, Niagara, no, it doesn't matter where it is. Canadian winemakers are very, very friendly. Probably the best example is each year we do a tasting at Canada House in London. Mm-hmm. And there's probably 40 wineries, a mix, so even Nova Scotia is there. And, you know, we all have dinner together. We present all of our wines together. It's not competition. It's you know, rising tide lifts all ships is how we look at it, and whether it's domestically or internationally, we all work together. But it's also another neat thing about Canadian wine is, you know, I'm lucky enough that I've traveled the wine world, and I can go to any winery in France, anywhere else, and they don't see us as a threat at this point in time. So they're sharing their ideas, they're letting you in, they're showing you how they make wine, and so we're making leaps and bounds because the wine world is open to us. So that's always nice as well.
Daryl, thank you so much for being part of the podcast, and I recommend everyone, if you're in Okanagan, go to Mission Hill. It's gorgeous. And you go there and you go, oh, look, it's a big, giant place. It's going to feel like a tourist trap. Well, no, the wines are fantastic. The view is great. The restaurant by the water. And maybe if you're there, you'll hear Sheryl Crow sing. You never know. Daryl, thanks again.
My pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.